we have 1 minute left.
So the resource area, actually, it's one of the things that came out of these trainings is, you know, how do we propagate the information that we share during these trainings? Would it be definitions or, you know, great work that we use to facilitate those conversations? So there is right next to the air room, if you come to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, if you come to the station right next to the air room, there's a resource area. It's all kinds of stuff pinned on the wall, and you could grab some of the handouts and stuff on there. And there's also more information about how to join and when next meetings are, etc.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Mike Klepfer and Delphi and Crescenzo.
Thank you.
Thank Mike you, Brian Crenshaw and Aaron.
And we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
All right.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. That was the evening news, followed by news from the Boo. Up next is Occupy Radio. We are going to go way back in the vault. We are going to hear from the second ever Occupy Portland radio show. It never aired. This was only on the web. And it is in anticipation of our fourth year anniversary coming up in the fall, at which time we may go back to the archives and bring you some unheard gems from back then. But before we get to that, a few messages.
Tune in to KBOO.FM on Friday, May 22nd. For a special broadcast live from the Secret Society. The Earnest Lovers, Pete Krebs and Lisa Bia, are releasing their CD, Sing Sad Songs, and we'll bring you their show with live sets from Kahalen Morrison and Country Hammer from Seattle, The Earnest Lovers, and Doug and Dee from the Midnight Serenaders. Again, that's KBOO broadcasting live from the Secret Society on Friday, May 22nd, starting at 9 p.m. Tune in at our homepage, kboo.fm. And more information can be found at kboo.fm/earnestloversrelease.
In the face of destruction. Again, that's Death Metal Angola at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome once again. This is KBOO Portland, and coming up next is Occupy Radio. Like I mentioned earlier, we're going to go back into the vault for some obscure radio, some obscure interviews. You're going to hear from an interview that was conducted in December of 2012, within a month of the camps being broken up here in Portland and around the country, around the world. We are going to talk with Dr. Jim Classified, Spo Gibbons, Tanya Hayes, and Emily Grace Miller. We're going to hear some music called Honeybee by Dr. Spo and a song called We Need a Theory to Continue. You'll get all that information in the program. This is Occupy Portland Radio's second ever show, which was only on the web. We'll go to that now.
It's about time. This is Occupy Portland Radio. This is Occupy Portland Radio. This is our second show. Welcome back. We're glad to be here. Hope you all enjoy listening and look forward to you sharing with us your contribution to our project. Today we're going to have some music from the Creative Commons licensing site www.anotherprotestsong.org. And we are going to have an interview that we conducted with some of our local occupants regarding the Portland Occupy experience and some cultural aspects of what went down here and is going down here now. And we'll close with a song from Dr. Spoh. And we'll start off today's show with a song that's available under Creative Commons license from anotherprotestsong.org. This is called We Need a Theory to Continue. Music by Najib Sabour. Lyrics by Angel Navarez and Valerie Tever.
From beyond the event horizon, with tonal clarity, above a dogma, brazenly skeptical for my life's power. Full reception, rearticulated, dissolving illusions of aggregate extinction. Passion, protest, if you the sanctimonious, need a theory to continue. The energy of life. The energy of life. I find troubles in choosing my metaphors without knowing the title. There are shadows on their faces. Realities remove from reality without direct communication. Why do I fit into this landscape? We need a theory. Energy of life.
That was We Need a Theory to Continue Music by Najib Sabour. Lyrics by Angel Navarez and Valerie Taver. It's available on a Creative Commons license. And we'll go now to an interview that we conducted here at the KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. I was joined by a handful of folks from the Portland Occupy camp, and we discussed some cultural comparison aspects, how the culture of Occupy Portland camp compared with our experience, and we also had some observations regarding the way that arts and culture play into the experience and getting out the message, and so we'll go to that now. This is Occupy Portland Radio. We are coming to you from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. We're joined in the KBOO studios with some of the local Occupy Portland members. I'm joined by Dr. Jim Classified, Spo Gibbons, Tanya Hayes, and Emily Grace Miller. How y'all doing?
Good. Well,
doing well.
Yeah, good to see you.
Average.
Okay. So we're here today, and we are having a discussion about the culture of the local Portland Occupy. And when we talk about culture, we're not just talking about art and music and that type of thing, but we're also talking about how human beings relate to each other and the mechanics of that, and perhaps even some of the fallout of how those relations go among us. And Dr. Jim, let me turn first to you and just kind of I'd really like to hear your thoughts regarding your personal degree of identification with the local Occupy movement and some of your thoughts and observations about just in general how you felt that degree of identification was among some of the people that you interacted with.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the invitation tonight as well. My feelings at the Occupy were that it was a very egalitarian system. I've been yelling at my TV for the last 5 or 6 years, thinking I was quite alone, but finding that there were people with similar thoughts and goals was pretty satisfying. I was also totally impressed with the degree of volunteerism that happened there, too. The egalitarian section of it, too, right, there's very little specialization. Everybody was responsible for everything. There's no isolation from a leaderless group, and then you're not isolated from people who make contributions to policy, and they're always available for conversation. Volunteerism is has been to me a kind of fading. I think it's a part of humanity to help other people, right. And but it seems in the society has given its accolades more towards accumulation of wealth and also demonization of people who might need help. So. For me, it was real satisfying to be there and be a part of that group. The population changed quite a bit over time, and it does continue to change. And each time, there are new challenges that we had to deal with. The process, it was all process-oriented, and I was not used to that way of doing things. And but I accepted the process and tried to work through it the way it was presented to me.
Right.
I think that it there was a lot of things I thought were missing in society. And to see the outpouring of people with concerns for each other was real refreshing for me. I certainly didn't understand the process. I'm certainly been more goal-oriented, but I think it also makes a statement, too, about that things need to change And trying to change the system from within seems impossible. And we all have been voting and writing letters and expressing ourselves, and we're not seeming to have much opportunity to make changes from the outside. So that a whole total new approach like this is consistent with the fact that a lot of change needs to be investigated and pursued. I saw too that there's a lot of caring for each other. I brought people together that wouldn't normally be together, and people, right. The support from the community was amazing, and they would just come by and thank us and offer to make donations, so that it was all donated. Was a total engine behind it was the kindness and the support from the people of Portland. So there are a lot of people outside of the camp who did understand what the purpose of Occupy was, or I should say direction. And fortunately, we were able to sift through a lot of the media representation that was presented, which I never felt was very accurate.
Right. So, Tanya, we were talking earlier, and you were telling me that you are a relative newcomer to the Portland Occupy movement. Is that correct?
Yes. I've been involved the last month or so, uh-huh. maybe a month and a half. And I wasn't actually camping there. But I do appreciate the goal of an egalitarian system. However, I can also see in my personal experience that, you know, nothing's perfect, and I believe that the whole movement is a big work in progress. Unfortunately, sometimes the idea that everyone can get heard means that the loudest person who shouts over other people sometimes gets heard the most. So I think, I really appreciate the effort and the idea surrounding it, but I mean, it's a work in progress.
Sure, sure. But you've decided to pitch in, and up until a month ago, what was your connection with Occupy? How were you encountering Occupy? Just through the media, or?
Yeah, I didn't actually know what it was about. And when I actually went to see what was it was about, I saw that it was very different than how it had been portrayed. And I went out that night, the eviction night, and then I feel like I understood after that night, just seeing how everyone was interacting with each other and seeing the intimidation of the police. And so after that, I realized I want to be a part of that.
Uh-huh. And Emily, you've been around for quite a while and been pretty heavily invested in the Occupy Portland. I'm curious what your observations are about the work ethic with Occupy Portland. It's a difficult thing to be a leaderless organization and have therefore accountability becomes a difficult thing to put in place. But obviously we've accomplished a lot. And what's going on with the work ethic? How has that affected that?
I think that Occupy created kind of a natural like meritocracy in a sense, because the more work you put into like the committee you were involved in or whatever you were doing, the more status or respect you gained in the camp and the more things that you had an opportunity to be involved in. And so in terms of work ethic, I think there was a lot of encouragement to work yourself to death. Like a lot of people didn't sleep a lot because there was just like a core group of volunteers who had incredible work ethic, who were super involved and did all they could for the movement. And I think that there is a lot of push to be one of those people who were super involved. But I think people accepted that, you know, some people lived in the normal world, they worked outside of it and they could only do as much as they could. So there was a balance between there being work ethic and people just putting in as much as they could.
Uh-huh.
I think one of the features, too, of the lack of specialization was one of kind of a human form responsibility that was taken on by occupiers, in that there was ownership and possession and being feeling a part of it that everybody was responsible. And that sort of community, I felt, became an important part of Occupy. We're all in this together, and everybody's valuable.
Sure, sure. So we're kind of structuring our conversation for the benefit of our listeners, just around some academic elements of comparing cultures one to another. Spill, I'd be interested in hearing your observations regarding that the concept of power distance that we were discussing earlier, which just again for the benefit of our listeners is just how likely is it or unusual is it that the top of the power structure as it is in a culture would actually be interacting with or hearing the voice of the bottom of the power structure as it is. What did you see going on there?
Do you mean with inside the Occupy movement?
Yeah.
Well, I saw that it seemed like there was this kind of almost invisible General Assembly group, it seemed, in my mind. I was like, how does this work? How does this work? It's like there was this almost like invisible kind of panel or committee that was maybe there facilitating the General Assembly meetings, and kind of shaping things. But at the same time, and I didn't know because a member of the camp and being the founder and director of the Peace on Earth Music Supply, which was soon to become the Music Stage. It was kind of like I was in my own little world there, but attended the General Assembly meetings as much as possible. But it seemed to me as though that because of the nature of the General Assembly, where everyone can stand up and say something, it seemed to me that the power distance was next to nothing in the sense that anyone had the ability to put forth an idea or a proposal that was put before the whole General Assembly each evening, which was whoever showed up from within the camp and even from outside of the camp to make a decision whether we should move forward on that proposal to do something positive within the camp. And that's everything from starting a new committee for the finance committee and the supply committee to creating some sort of outreach of that sort. And then also going forward, there was one evening where this one gentleman, a brilliant man, stood up and gave a list of things that we should be doing. It was still relatively early. We were still stumbling, or finding our way with all the great joy, it seemed to me, involved in the possibilities of what we can do together. And so this man stood up and gave a whole list of things what we should do, from canceling our bank accounts at the regular banks to taking out starting accounts at the credit unions, to keeping our money here, to all sorts of things on multiple levels. He had like 26 items. And I was like, man, how brilliant. And that's exactly what we needed to do. We needed to say, okay, now that we're here, now that we've begun, we need to start thinking about what it really means for us to make change in this world. What do we want? And his list was brilliant. And I actually stood up a meeting either that same night. It was at the end of the meeting, and I stood up and mentioned that gentleman and asked that he or someone print out the words that he spoke as an example of what we need to start considering, like how we want to take what we're going to do to make this thing happen and make this thing work. So in answer to your question, I guess that really brings it down to the distance of power from the top to the bottom. Was like we are all able to step up to the mic and at any point in time do a mic check and call out that something we had something we wanted to share. But this was the General Assembly every meeting every night at 7 p.m., which to me is though that, hey, you can't just walk into Congress and say, I want to say something.
Right.
Right? I don't think you can. There's far too many cacklers already. There's too many, But, so the power distance was right there. If you were a part of the community, you had the right to step up to the General Assembly any night and either make a proposal or make an announcement or say how you felt. And right. That's beautiful. That right. was really beautiful right there.
Yeah, that horizontal structure kind of led to a circumstantial power distance. If you weren't able to make the meeting that night, then you didn't have a chance to express yourself. But if you could make the meeting, you did have the chance to express yourself. And there was no pressure from the structure or the organization that was really influencing that. That was kind of my experience.
Right. It was all about attendance. And right. it was important to attend, but at the same, because you might have missed something. But then most proposals that get voted on then have to go and get go through the process before they get implemented and everything like that. And most ideas, the cool thing was, is if you had a proposal, it got to the point where you had to write it up and then present it to the facilitators team, and so that they could at least know what to announce of significant proposals that were coming up after the general announcements.
Right.
So sure. But yeah, in the sense of being able to just step right up to the microphone and have your voice heard by everyone at the General Assembly, and because we had the interwebs and because we had our web team that was broadcasting live over the internet every meeting, I had people, my friends actually, would come up to me and go, Spo, I heard you at the General Assembly right. the other night. It was cool. I was like, thanks a lot. I got some inspiration and stood up. And they were like, and so they weren't able to be there, but they could witness it and listen to it live. And there was chat that was going on the side of people that also weren't able to make it, but were listening and all live.
Right.
So that was an awesome thing. The technology that we were able to utilize, was fantastic.
Sure.
It's fantastic. It sure. still is, and we're going to keep using it.
Yeah. So that gives me a good segue into another axis that we can compare the Occupy culture with what we might be a little more familiar with. And that's the degree to which our culture is open or closed. And whether anybody coming in from the outside encountered any resistance. And you were commenting on how, you know, anybody could just walk into a General Assembly. And Tanya, not to put you on the spot here, but the four of us, I think, got involved fairly early in the Occupy process as it was. And I'm pretty sure that the four of you would agree with me that it was extremely easy to get involved. It was a very open system.
Definitely.
When you were starting to get involved, Tanya, did you feel like it was open and welcoming and very easy for you to get involved? How was your experience?
Well, I felt like there was a few avenues that I could get into it from, and I did find a group that I felt that I could understand. I did have to kind of go back and do a little bit of homework about, you know, some guidelines and some background. And for the first few meetings, I didn't really know the process yet. And so, but I did feel like, I mean, there's something that anybody can do, and there's it branches out so much because it's a leaderless movement. So I feel like there's something anyone can do if they wanted to get involved.
Right. And so maybe the what I'm hearing you say is maybe the only barriers, if you will, were kind of structure driven, just so that you'd feel comfortable participating once you knew kind of how to go about voicing your concerns or when it was an appropriate time for you to say whatever you had to say. And it sounds as if you're telling me that once you kind of had that under control, you felt, yeah, okay, now I'm in.
Yeah, I do feel like anybody who wants to contribute can do it. I mean, but the movement's not completely separate from, you know, our regular society. I feel like it's a lot more forward thinking and a lot more egalitarian. However, you know, we can't get away from the norms in our own society, you know, which include all the isms, the sexism and the racism. So I feel like there's still those elements in there because, you know, even if the movement is made out of people who are forward thinking, you know, we all still were born and raised in a
in this society. So I feel like there's still underlying kind of issues that need to be talked about, you know, because it is a work in progress and it's not perfect, but denying that there's any kind of privilege difference within the movement, I think that's not truthful to the movement.
This is Occupy Portland. We are listening to a first time aired episode. This is a conversation that was recorded in December of 2012, shortly after the Occupy encampments were broken up. I interviewed Dr. Jim Classified Spo Gibbons, Tanya Hayes, and Emily Grace Miller. We'll go back to that interview now.
To the movement.
So let me just make sure I understand what you're saying is that it's not quite egalitarian yet.
I don't think it is, and especially if we don't talk about the problems that usually aren't talked about in society, then I don't think that we can fix them without, you know, we're obviously geared towards economic inequality, but there's still a lot of other kinds of inequality that we face. And so if we ignore those in this movement, then I don't think we're making as much progress as we could if we did.
Sure, sure. We've still got some biases that we all carry with us, and at least we can feel good about the fact that this may be an opportunity to address that. Emily, did you want to chime in there?
Yeah, I was just going to say that there's definitely a balance between the Occupy movement and like our society we live in now, because we all come from this socialized atmosphere of capitalism and sexism, and just we're just taught to think a certain way. And I think that a common sentiment within Occupy Portland was, we're all together, we're so progressive, and there was this denial to talk about sexism. And I was a part of the safety committee, which was very patriarchal. The points of contact were all men, and that was like the power structure of if there was an incident, those were the first people to be called. And it took a month for a woman to be recognized as a POC, and she had the same amount of experience. And I think that there was this common, like, let's not talk about that issue right now. We're talking about bigger issues. And I think as a movement, we have to address the different levels of privilege, as gender privilege and class privilege and racial privilege are very prevalent in our society. And I just think it's very necessary to address those different levels of privilege and to come to terms with them. And I think the Occupy movement is working to become egalitarian and working to become that this new paradigm of socialization. However, we have a lot of work to do, and it's hard to come to terms with your privilege. But we definitely strive towards that, but we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing that you just said, that it is hard to come to terms with your privilege. So just, you know, since it's been such a short period of time, what are we, two months and 3 weeks into this locally, and maybe 3 months nationally was when the, I think we're somewhere around, how do you feel like we've done with so little time?
I feel like coming to terms with your privilege is a very individual experience. I can speak to myself. Living in the camp, I came to terms with my class privilege. Like I was staying next to people that had like a history of poverty and were in the cycle of poverty that they felt like they couldn't get out of because of this capitalist system, society that we're living in. And like as a middle class, white woman, I never really realized how privileged I was, because I was in that balance between I had everything I needed and I wasn't like rich or wealthy. So I was privileged enough not to come to terms with my privilege. And I think that the camp really helped me to come to terms with that and to realize that as an individual, even with my ethical drive, I still, institutionally oppress people by banking at Wells Fargo or buying a dress from a certain company or whatever. And just understanding that as individuals, we, as ethical as we want to be, we can still participate in oppressive parts of our society. And I think the Occupy movement has a lot of potential to help people come to terms with that. And it's a process. And I think the willingness to come to terms with that and to let go of your ego is something that helps you let go of that identification with of privilege. And so that's my experience.
Yeah, that can be a scary thing to encounter, one's privilege and coming to terms with that. But also, it seems as if it is kind of a very ego-centric notion, and that can be a very scary thing to face one's ego, which, again, allows us to kind of touch on another aspect of our cultural discussion here today, which is risk aversion. And so basically, again, for the benefit of our listeners, we all face risk in our life. And the United States, as a cultural entity, has a certain degree of, at least in my experience, we're fairly comfortable with risk. We understand that risk is basically essential to the capitalist system. So we've kind of been very encouraged to accept at least a certain degree of risk. And you could compare that with, I have some very close friends who come from like socialist countries and that. And from my experience, they seem to be a little bit more uncomfortable with the concept of risk. How do you think our efforts at addressing risk went in camp and in the movement in general so far?
Well, could you be a little more specific as far as the risk aversion part of it? Because, I mean, every day was a risk being in camp.
Sure.
Because there was threats, and there were people that were actually, unfortunately, generating paranoia and fear that the cops are coming in and they're going to storm us tonight. Or the cops are going to storm us, and it's all going to be, and they're bringing in, you know, just all these rumors. I think the rumors created fear within some people. Myself being, I'm not wanting to hear the fear. I wanted to hear the truth. What's happening? Who knows? How do they know? When I began to hear fearful things, statements made, and then to realize hours go by and then realize, no, that's not true at all. And I would just mention it to someone. So, but the risk aversion the risk itself, every day, you're at risk for all kinds of things, because what we had at Occupy Portland, as well as I'm sure all the other occupies, is we had a microcosm of the city we live in, and we had a microcosm of the actual nation here, the United States, that we live in. It seemed to me that it was very rapid that almost all the ills of society appeared, like pimples on the face of a teenager. Like very quickly, you know, we had the homeless people come apparently they were being given sleeping bags from the Portland Concern and various homeless shelters saying, go to Occupy. And they knew that they would get fed three times a day because we had the most amazing support in our outside donors, our Occupy supporters on the outside that kept donating food like incredible amounts. There was three meals made every day, snacks in between, and there was, you know, there was even a midnight snack that was, you would never go hungry. And so that was quite amazing. But it was also quite the challenge for me to maintain my balance within camp when the threat of violence was happening every day, every night, where it sounded like the Vikings were coming down off the mountain 3 o'clock in the morning, almost every night, and not knowing from which direction they were coming because of the nature of the actual angle of the camps being slanted, and we're on a hill. But, you know, so it was kind of like... I think the risk factor of just being in camp was like you took your life into your hands every day. I experienced theft, where a bag of mine, I had a little mini disc recorder, which for the first 4 days I was recording sounds of Occupy that I thought were awesome, as well as my own running commentary on what was happening in my black bag. It got stolen. That black bag got stolen. My mini disc was gone. So theft was right there. And I believe that theft was directly related to the nature of addiction. We had tweakers. We had alcoholics. We had perhaps heroin people as well. But we had people that were stealing because they had needed a fix. So right there, we had all the ills of society come down upon us. And within 30 days, we're supposed to be able to solve all those problems.
Right.
And if we didn't, the media and the mayor and everyone said, see, Occupy can't do that. We've never been able to do it either.
Yeah. So some of this greater national culture aversion to risk, right, which is a very human thing.
Right.
I mean, let's just face that. Some of that did exert itself in the perception that the rest of the city and the area had of what was going on with us. But I do want to say that, you know, just in my own personal opinion, it was scary, and it did feel like you were taking your life into your hands, and you were taking your life in your hands, and yet we stayed.
And yet we stayed. Because we held on to the ideal of what Occupy could and did represent and does represent. The change that we need, our government has failed us. They're not taking care of business. The businesses have taken over the government. Right. They're taking care of business, which is not taking care of us.
Right.
So therefore, yeah, it was the hope and the ideal. And that's exactly why I stayed, because we need change now.
Yeah. So, Dr. Jim, earlier you made mention of your observations on the process, and I understand as a medical professional, it may be more about the goal versus the process due to your training and your experience. Well, do you have any thoughts on how you saw goal versus process playing itself out in camp?
Well, certainly. I went for people. I just want to say a few things about risk and how humans assess risk, and it's not always very logical. They'll assess risks, related to how scary it is. For one thing, I mean, people lose sleep over sharks, and 9 people are killed by sharks every year. But 126 are killed by deer, and nobody loses sleep over that. Nor do people worry about getting in a car and driving, which is the most dangerous thing we do. But one of the ways we assess risk, too, is what's the benefit, or what's the drive to endure that risk? Is it worth it?
Right.
And I think that kept a lot of people in camp. It did exceed those criteria for a lot of people, and they felt safer leaving, and that they should have done. That was totally appropriate. I'm more used to being having the answers and like being in charge, to have to and then to adopt the process of consensus. I couldn't see how it could possibly work, and I was maybe a little critical of it at first. I also had the feeling that Spo mentioned, too, that maybe there's something behind the curtain here that's kind of guiding it, because things are getting done, and the direction is, although slow, is going in the right direction. But I think that it was more the fact that we're all working for our best angels as far as wanting to help each other and starting to think about other people and not just ourselves, the egocentric things that Emily mentioned, that was what was guiding us, and that's what was motivating us. And with that, we were able to stay alive and keep the process going as it is still going today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all of that, you know, from, again, I hate to keep adding my piece here, that's not really my role, but I do want to say, you know, we didn't really have a goal, did we? Did we really know what we were doing? We were was our goal to change everything? That's a pretty big goal. Emily?
Yeah, well, I think that that's an interesting point, because I feel like there's a balance between the symbolism of what the Occupy movement meant and what direction we were going for, and then also this like material, like what are, you know, like the media was trying to put a picture to us and trying to put this, like, you know, our list of 10 demands that we were trying to change. And the Occupy movement is to me as an individual, it's a consciousness shift, it's a paradigm shift, it's a different way of thinking. It's occupying your thoughts, it's occupying your heart, and through our Occupy movement, things will develop that are material, and our direction will materialize. And I mean, you can even see that with the 99 versus 1%. That's not a true statistic. I mean, that's not like a scientific, like, you know, researched idea. It's an idea of this power structure that we're all very much a part of, and it, you know, it's And when people ask who is the 1%, it's more of a symbol than, you know, like a family, or, and very much a families fit into the 1%, but it's a symbol, and it's a representative of this balance between the infancy of this movement and how it's developing into a materialistic thing and like a list of goals and a list of processes. But very much right now, it's a symbol, and it's a movement building, and it's a different way of thinking. It's occupying your heart and your mind.
Yeah, I think the initial impetus on Wall Street was to get money out of politics. And so on that basis, I think it's like 0.5% people donate $200 or more to political candidates. And it's easy to see that that's the people that are influencing government and policy. And so it's 99.5% on that with that scale. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So all it would cost me is $200 and I'd be part of the 1%.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. See if I can go scratch that up.
Nobody would listen to you on that with that donation, but
yeah. Money is free speech.
Right. I would just probably end up donating it to the wrong candidate anyway. Without a chance to win. So just a couple more aspects of this phenomenon I'd like to touch on before we move into maybe a brief or whatever commentary about arts and culture in camp. Just a couple things I'd like to get your feelings on were our relationship to the environment and the degree of acceptance of leadership styles that we saw at camp, and just you know, how you guys saw that play itself out and what your observations were on that. Anybody want to?
I'd start. I felt that because of the number of people that so quickly filled the two parks where we were at the Occupy Portland, it became quite a challenge to maintain, you know, day-to-day sanitation, if you will, and things of that sort. We had issues, but I do remember that there was a keen awareness. We were doing all we could to recycle everything, reuse if possible. I do remember that there was someone that even said, you don't want to nail anything into a tree. When I thought, I'll nail my sign up to the tree. He goes, no, try not to nail it. Just see if you can string it around the tree. So we were trying to respect the environment as much as possible. I think the influx, like any city, any major city, it's the quantity of the population that puts the stress on the local environment. And we had a packed house for quite a long time that was overloaded amazingly. You'd step out of your tent and there'd be three new tents where there weren't any in the morning, and you wouldn't know where you were. That happened to me a couple of times. I was like, where am I? You know, this doesn't look like what I fell asleep to.
Right.
You know,
disorienting.
So the population was very dense within the two parks. It changed over time and dwindled a little bit towards the end. But I felt we were trying to be as much as respectful to the environment as possible. But at the same time, there were anything anywhere, drop it. There was trash everywhere. And I, you know, used to pick up trash quite a bit and try to help out with the kitchen and stuff. And it was never ending. It's like the world. You go down any street in Portland, there's trash everywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, the streets usually are cleaned every so often. They have street workers and everything like that. But, you know, somehow people keep throwing the crap. And I'll tell you one of the reasons why. There aren't enough trash cans everywhere, Mr.
Sure.
Mayor. Mr. Mayor,
right.
Not enough trash cans.
Just quickly, since we're talking about that, I'd like to put in a plug for the Portland Occupy Street Clean Team Unit 1. We are looking for people to join us.
Awesome.
Look for us out there on the street. We're bringing the cleanup of our home to your neighborhood.
Occupy your garbage can.
Yeah, that's right.
That population, that population density in that environment. It'd be very difficult to maintain the environment. We lost the environment of a park. with that many people.
Well, there's the density of the population, correct?
Yeah,
that's
population density.
Yeah. With no like, with no real leader or person that's like telling everyone what to do, it was really hard to centralize like a way to clean up and for people all to respect that because everyone had different interests and different ways of contributing, and to centralize that like garbage and stuff with such a quantity of garbage coming in.
Yeah.
That would have been quite a task.
Yeah, yeah, a definite shout out to the sanitation group. They were getting hammered the whole time.
That was a rough job.
Yeah, and they stuck with it. Yeah. And, they did fairly well.
Indeed.
So, ladies, I wanna say the last word for the two of you because I think you have definitely some varying perspectives on the leadership style here with our Portland Occupy movement. And I think that may be driven just by the points in time in which you became involved with the local Occupy. So let me start with you, Emily, and share some of your reflections on leadership within the movement, and what's that all about? It's a leaderless movement, right? What's up with leadership?
Well, I mean, in camp, there was definitely almost a fear of having a leader, having someone who capitalized on power, which I think was a valid fear, because that's our society is like largely dictated by these certain people who hold a lot of money. But through that process and through that like automatic refusal to have someone in a leadership position, people were doing it in secretive ways, which was even more frightening, I think. And accepting that certain people are going to be charismatic and take leadership roles is just part of human nature. And I think that people had different ways of gaining a leadership and role and gaining powers. Like in different committees, there was points of contact which was kind of like inherently a power structure, which created power distance. And in safety, it was very patriarchal, very hard as a woman to gain a leadership role and to have your voice heard. And then in education, I was a part of the education committee, and it was totally different. Like anyone, it didn't matter what your gender was, everyone and or privilege, people were very conscious and had a lot of self-analysis in those terms. And it was easy to gain power and to lead in that way. And through accepting people's different levels of privilege and different genders, I think that we as a group and a committee got a lot of things done and continue to get a lot of things done because we all work together as leaders. So I think that there's different ways of leading, and I have a way that I think is the most positive, and it's hard. It's definitely hard, but I've definitely found a more inclusive and empowering everyone to be leaders, I think, is the most effective way, although it's difficult to not have a centralized face to a movement. But I think that there's merit in giving it a try.
Sure. And so, Tanya, what's your experience been with the leadership structure of Occupy Portland since you've been involved? How's that working for you?
Well, it's completely different now that I am involved. And I just want to remind anyone who is not yet involved that before I got involved, when you see someone representing an occupier or even a group doing something, it makes you think, oh, all of Occupy is doing this, all of Occupy is doing that. And then once I entered into it and was trying to figure it out, I realized that if you see one person who identifies as an occupier or even a group, what they're doing is not necessarily supported by, you know, the whole Occupy Portland. And there's no, you should assume that, I mean, or you can't assume that it's supported by the whole national Occupy movement. So I just would want to remind people that if they see a few people who identify as an occupier doing something, whether it's good or bad, just know that it doesn't identify everybody, because, you know, you can't get so many people to agree on everything. And I feel like it's a movement that has a lot of tentacles out in different directions. So there's a lot of progress on different fronts, and there's a lot of different things of different sizes getting done. But also, yeah, just remember, if you see, you know, a group of people doing something you don't like, you just don't assume that they have, you know, like, quote unquote, the permission of everyone in the Occupy movement, because they probably don't.
Yeah, the best illustration that I have of that point right there is the guy, I won't mention his name, but the night of the eviction, who I believe he's the guy who threw the fireworks out and tried to spook the horses, and I think
it definitely doesn't represent everybody.
and it's, you know, it's, I just want to remind everybody that what happened with that was he threw a little jumping spinner light, you know, very, very low level firework out on the ground, and it spooked a horse, and the horse kicked a police officer, and the police officer got hurt. And the next thing that happened was that the rest of us pushed him out into the hands of the police, and they took it from there. Yeah. So, you know, that's a very, very telling event for me, is we just, oh no, here you go, this is the guy, we don't want him here.
Unacceptable.
Yeah, that was totally unacceptable. So I guess we're gonna wrap it up here. But before we do, we have the world debut of
Honeybee, the song by me, Dr. Spo, which I performed a number of times live in camp at the Occupy Portland over the course of our time there. So yeah, Honeybee. I think the second verse of Honeybee speaks to Occupy everywhere. So so yeah, here it is. Honeybee by Dr. Spo.
So from the studios of KBOO, I've been joined by Dr. Jim Classified, Spo Gibbons, Tanya Hayes, Emily Grace Miller. Joe Lito has been kind enough to step in and do our engineering. I'm Jimmy Tardy, and this is Occupy Radio. Thanks for listening.
Yes, once again, thank you for listening. That was a previously unaired episode of Occupy Portland Radio, recorded in December of 2012. We heard from a handful of people who were present and part of the movement during the encampments. And thank you for listening, and have a good night.
Hello, KBOO members. You are invited to attend KBOO's Mission and Vision Retreat on May the 30th from noon to 4 p.m. This retreat is an opportunity for members to support the development of a mission and vision statement for KBOO and to share your valuable knowledge about your community radio station. If you would like to attend the retreat on May the 30th, get in touch with Monica Beamer and RSVP by sending her an email at monica@kboo.org or calling 503-231-8032, extension 201. More details about the agenda for the retreat will be sent to you when you RSVP. We hope to see you on May the 30th, and thank you for being an active member of KBOO.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Tumation needs a TTT. Thank you for your love, for your cat, for your kind.
The time is 7 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Hard Knock Radio is next.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
One, two, three, four, five, six.
History is here.